Welcome to Future of Freedom. I'm your host, Scott Bertram. Future of Freedom is a production of America's Talking Network. You can check out all of our great podcasts at americastalking.com. To support great podcasts like this one, please donate by clicking the link in the show description. We bring you interviews today from both sides of the debate over the place of nationalism in the center-right movement. In a little bit, we'll be joined by Stephanie Slade. She's senior editor at Reason. Right now, Rich Lowry, editor at National Review, author of the book, The Case for Nationalism, How It Made Us Powerful, United, and Free. Rich, thanks so much for joining us.
Of course, thanks for having me.
Discussing today the place of nationalism in the right of center movement, your book is The Case for Nationalism. Could it have been the case for patriotism? If not, where do you draw distinctions?
Yeah, so that's a great question, because nomenclature is a big part of this debate. And I think functionally, patriotism and nationalism are largely indistinguishable kind of in popular usage. But if you want to get technical about it, patriotism, which a lot of people think is the word for everything that's good, and national feeling and nationalism is the word for everything bad, I think that's totally wrong. But anyway, patriotism, the root is patre, same as patriarchy. It's love of your own, love of the land of your fathers, which is a very natural and important human sentiment. And nationalism, though, is something more specific, which is the doctrine or idea that a distinct people, united by a distinct history, culture, language, should govern a distinct piece of territory. And this is a very old concept, didn't begin to be fully realized, though, until the 18th and 19th century. And that really defines the modern world. Even people who are allergic to the word nationalism, at the end of the day, they are nationalists. Almost everyone believes that countries should have sovereign borders that shouldn't be violated, and that people have a right to govern themselves. And at a bottom, that's what nationalism is about. A nation belongs to its people. And this is, again, even folks on the radical left, even people on who are radical libertarians, they at the end of the day, they might come up with different words for it, but they all accept this kind of baseline nationalism that is a crucial part of our modern world.
There's a chapter in The Case for Nationalism, which is the smear against nationalism, opponents who would critique it as inherently militaristic, undemocratic, flat-out racist. They point to the past and say, look what nationalism has given us before. Are they wrong in using the examples they use, or is American nationalism inherently something unique?
Yeah, I think a little of both. There's this idea that, gosh, you know, we have nations, and they go to war with one another occasionally, and this is terrible. This is the fault of nationalism, when really violence and warfare are endemic to the human condition across all forms of political organization. You know, there is a fallacious, lazy idea tribal peoples are uniquely peace-loving, when actually this is based on misunderstandings of anthropologists. And actually, if you look back through the myths of human history, you'll find, you know, just a huge proportion of males prior to the more formal organizations of states were killed in violent ways. You look at empires, you look at kingdoms, they were not peace-loving. You know, the Roman Empire, the most important example in the West, was basically a military machine. It crushed everyone in its path. So it's just not true that the rise of nations as we know them coincided with the rise of warfare that's always been with us. Now, any powerful human impulse can be abused, and of course, nationalism has been abused. Played into the conflagrations in Europe in the 20th century, no doubt about it. But there are different kinds of nationalism. There can be, you know, an illiberal, dictatorial nationalism, and then there's a small d democratic nationalism. And in World War II, it was democratic nationalists who prevailed. You know, Churchill, De Gaulle, FDR especially. You know, De Gaulle and Churchill were still colonialists, which is an anti-nationalist project in impulse. But the Atlantic Charter and the FDR vision of sovereign nations ultimately won out, and that's a very good thing. And then there's American nationalism, which has always been different than European nationalism, has a more idealistic element to it. I think American nationalism tends more to be civic nationalism, but is not entirely civic nationalism. But civic nationalism is about the equality of citizens, about a faith in your institutions, a belief in certain civic ideals. And that's a broad swath of American nationalism, but it's not it in its entirety.
One question that needs to be answered is this idea of whether or not America has this cultural core as a nation, and taking that a step forward, if so, does government itself have a role in preserving mm-hmm. that culture?
Yeah, I think both are true. There's no such thing as just a country that's just made up of totally free-floating individuals and that has no cultural coherence. And that's not true of America. I wholly reject the idea that America is an idea, as people say. Our ideals are important, but no one lives in an idea, and we're united by a common store of cultural knowledge, cultural practices, most importantly, a common language. Mm-hmm. And this sort of cultural coherence makes possible the social trust upon which all our institutions and democracy ultimately depend. And you have various third world countries that can't make democracy work and are constantly beset by civil war and coups because they don't have this common cultural feeling, this common national feeling. So it's very the liberal nationalism in the United States depends on this more grounded and elemental nationalism.
Talking with Rich Lowry, editor at National Review, author of The Case for Nationalism. Rich, do you consider nationalism a virtue? Is it a moral good?
Yes, it's definitely a virtue. As I was just alluding to, countries that lack it tend to fall apart and tend to not have institutions that can withstand various other loyalties, either above or beneath national loyalties, whether it's a sect or whether it's clan and tribe. So it's very important that countries have a basic nationalism. And if you don't, you're not going to your country is basically not going to work. And to go back, actually, Scott, I realize I didn't answer part of your earlier question. There is a role for government in supporting nationalism and basic civic practices and education in a country's culture and history. That is a governmental role.
I was talking by chance earlier today with a St. Ignatius expert, and he reminded me of an Ignatius quote, which is, "Diversity is commonly the mother of discord and the enemy of union of wills." We are at a time where our national unity is under attack and assault, both from the outside and from the inside. When you look at the country today, is nationalism a response to some of the diversity we see and some of the attack on what would be considered the nation itself?
Yeah, so historically, the United States has been able to accommodate, you know, astonishing level of diversity and immigration because there's been this basic nationalist consensus. You know, you come here and you become part of the team. You sign up for a bargain, which is, you know, faith in the Declaration, loyalty to the Constitution, a belief in the country's national heroes, from George Washington to Abraham Lincoln, who are available to anyone of any background and any race or creed. So I still think that's true, but it's fraying. And if it really fundamentally gives way, we're not going to like the effect, because if you lose that loyalty to the nation and the pillars of the nation, people are loyal to something, right? And it will be you know, partisan affiliations or tribal or racial affiliations, and that would be a big step backwards.
Rich, can nationalism exist without some element of coercion, without some element of encouraging and, let's say, forcing people to go along for the ride, to go along with this nationalist feeling across a nation?
There should be efforts to encourage people to buy in to the bargain, but you know, we're a free country, and you're free to hate America. You're free to hate, you know, say George Washington is desperately flawed, and we shouldn't hold him up as an exemplar. You know, we shouldn't do it with Jefferson. Obviously, he's the founder under the most pressure. We shouldn't do it for Lincoln for various reasons. But I think the country and its educational system should tilt towards encouraging people to recognize the great virtues of such figures and the great virtues of the country and its history. It doesn't mean the history shouldn't be truthful. Doesn't mean it shouldn't account for the country's sins in a way that, you know, didn't happen for a very long time. So I think some of the criticisms of nationalism and patriotism and patriotic education, you know, had some force and have led to adjustments. It's just that now we're really threatening to tip over in a wholly different direction. Really, the first time a society has had educational institutions and elite institutions telling itself that it is no good, that is fundamentally corrupt and racist. That's just really never that I'm aware of happened in human history, and I don't think we're going to like the results.
Rich, the subtitle from the book, How Nationalism Made the U.S. Powerful, United, and Free. What do you point to as some of the accomplishments that the country has been able to achieve that you in some part attribute to nationalism? Do we win World War II without some sense of nationalism? Do we go to the moon without some sense of nationalism?
Yeah, I think all those are good examples. You know, at the outset, the American Revolution was a nationalist revolution. You know, in the scheme of things, we were quite free prior to the revolution, and compared to other colonial empires throughout human history, you know, the British obviously had their flaws, but it was not the worst empire to live in. But the basic impulse was, hey, we now realize, you know, we've been here on these shores largely self-governing for 150 years, and you know what? We're our own people. And since we're our own people, we're going to govern ourselves. That's basically, at bottom, a nationalist impulse or project. Then you get, you know, the Articles of Confederation, which are not working, and you have the nationalists in the context of the time. You know, Washington and Hamilton, Madison for a while, although he flakes off from Washington and Hamilton, saying, you know what, we need a national government that works and is worthy of the name. So that's how you get the Constitution. Obviously, Civil War nationalism is stress tested. It's Lincoln's strong belief that we're one country, that the original compact was not breakable, that there was no natural geographic division in the country that can work. So we're one and indivisible, and we're going to fight to defend that idea. And then in the 20th century, we kind of have this consensus nationalism driven really by the experience of World War II, where, you know, a country is under military threat there's always going to be a nationalist reaction to that. It can be nasty or it can be benign. I think ours was benign, but if you want people to buy war bonds, if you want people to undertake rationing or tolerate rationing, if you want people to sign up for the military or be willing to be drafted and go, you know, thousands of miles from home, these young men, and risk your lives, there's got to be a faith in the cause and in the nation. And FDR, you know, if you want a sort of expression of this kind of nationalism, go and listen to his D-Day prayer, which is just extremely eloquent and moving, and an expression of this kind of nationalism. Then it falls through in the 20th century during the Cold War. You know, the space race is a nationalist enterprise. Reagan is a kind of nationalist, but then it slowly broke down, and this is what at least in the Republican Party created the opening for Donald Trump to reappeal to these kind of sentiments, you know, in his inimitable style, for better or worse, but kind of the nationalist baton had kind of been left on the floor for a while, and he picked it up.
One final question for Rich Lowry here on the Future of Freedom podcast. Are you worried at all? Is it a worry about too much nationalism? Does too much nationalism lead to, say, an increase in centralized state power, something conservatives would want to avoid? Is there such a thing as too much nationalism, even here in the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, there's such a thing as too much of almost everything, except for maybe, you know, love or faith in our God. But yeah, and within the debate on the right, you have the people who are more inclined to be protectionist, more inclined to be isolationist. They'll reject these exact words or descriptions, more inclined towards a version of industrial policy, will call themselves nationalists because they believe that we got away from the national interest because we had too gauzy a view of our ability to spread our ideals abroad, or that we let the market overwhelm the fact that there are borders and inherent, you know, economic tensions between various countries, especially, you know, us and China, that cannot be effaced by the market. And I think all these arguments are worth engaging with. I do not, you know, reject them out of hand. I'm willing to debate and argue and change my mind as warranted. But I think that kind of nationalism could lead the right to some policy mistakes. So my nationalism is a really kind of lowest common denominator nationalism. We're a sovereign country, our borders matter, and the test of all policy should be, is it in the national interest?
Rich Lowry, editor at National Review, author of The Case for Nationalism. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Future of Freedom podcast.
Thanks so much, Scott. I enjoyed it.
For a different view on the topic, we turn now to Stephanie Slade. She is senior editor at Reason. You can find her on Twitter, too, at Slade, S-R. Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Scott, for having me.
I'll begin by asking the question, what is the place of nationalism? Is there a place for nationalism in the right-of-center movement here in America?
Well, I think the answer to that question is necessarily going to depend on how we define or understand nationalism. And that's been a question that I've had over the last few years as I've been reading about and attending conferences and covering the rise of this new national conservatism movement for Reason and other publications. Because I think the word nationalism is a little confusing to people. It can mean a lot of different things. Some people, I think, use it merely to mean something like to have love for or pride in your country. And I think that's probably the way that, closest to the way that somebody like Rich Lowry would use the word nationalism. But, you know, even from the very beginning, when this new nationalist movement was arising a few years ago, I started wondering, well, you know, we have a word for that, and a word that doesn't have a lot of baggage attached to it, and that would be patriotism. So why is there this need to try to revive or resuscitate or recapture or reclaim nationalism as a term? And what I found as I followed the movement over the last few years, is that they really do go far beyond just talking about we want to promote patriotism, love of country, pride in country, a willingness to sacrifice for your country, a desire to see your country thrive. but rather there is a real policy agenda, an economic nationalist policy agenda that comes along with this term and this movement that is very I would describe as a big government and coercive. That would be the sort of defining characteristic of this movement, is that they want to embrace, you know, a powerful central national government, federal government. And that is something quite different and goes quite, you know, far beyond just wanting to promote patriotism or love of country.
Reading your writings on this this nationalism on the right, that word coercion comes up often, the idea of coercion versus liberty. Are you convinced in your coverage that the nationalism as discussed on the right and center right these days cannot exist in a benign state, meaning without these calls for government action or coercion of other Americans?
I think the national conservatives are very open that an embrace of quote-unquote muscular government is central to their program. And I don't think they would describe that as, I think they would say that, well, it can be benign and coercive. I would disagree. You know, I'm writing as a libertarian, a classical liberal, somebody who believes very deeply in limited government and individual freedom. And so any move away from those things within the conservative movement, to me, would be abandoning the things that both that conservatism rightly stands for, and that the sort of things that make America what she is and what makes America great. So to get back to your original question, is there a place for nationalism? Could there be a benign nationalism? To the extent that we're just talking about love of country or pride of country, I'm all for it. My father served in the Army for 23 years. The first thing I did when I moved into my dorm room my freshman year of college was hang an American flag above my bed. I have no problem with the idea that we ought to be proud of our country. We ought to want to see the country thrive. We ought to be willing to sacrifice for the nation, and we ought to, you know, raise our children to believe that these things are important as well. But to the extent that we're redefining conservatism to be embracing muscular government, big government conservatism, the use of coercion, and not just the use of coercion, but the idea, the goal of acquiring power, state power, and wielding it to go after it, to destroy our enemies, our political enemies. And again, we're talking about fellow Americans when we're talking about our enemies, because this is a political program. This sort of thing, and this really does come out quite explicitly when you listen to the national conservatives, when you go to their conference. I've been to two out of their three big annual conferences in person. I've read their statement of principles. I've been following the writers, you know, read Rich Lowry's book, so on and so forth. And what I find is the coercion is the point. They want power. They say that openly, and they disdain people like me, classical liberal conservatives or libertarians. I identify as a libertarian, small L libertarian, for being squeamish about willing to acquire and wield power to go after our enemies.
The supporters of this nationalism might argue that a more muscular government, a more muscular response is needed because our national identity is under assault in some ways, whether it be externally through the threat of globalism or the United Nations or this idea of the Great Reset, which is now being discussed, or internally from things like you know, the renaming of schools and buildings and tearing down of statues, not just of symbols of the Confederacy, but of Washington and Jefferson and the 1619 Project writ large, and trying to seed this discord and changing the way we tell our history. Do you think that our national identity is under assault in any meaningful way that would necessitate this sort of response?
Well, I would say that there are plenty of ways in which our national identity is always going to be under assault. But whether that necessitates or justifies the response that some of the conservative nationalists are calling for is a different question. And there, I would object. So, you know, you may believe that we ought to be skeptical of the idea of supranational or transnational governing institutions, the EU, the UN, so on and so forth, that we ought to want to defend the right of sovereign nations to make policy for themselves and not be bound up and or dependent upon other countries. I think that's fair. That's an argument that conservatives could make. They want to, you know, there's this idea that power should be located closer to the individual and to the community as opposed to farther away. So why go to Brussels, for example, if we could have decisions made that are going to affect Americans' lives directly from Washington. I think that's a fair argument. But my question is, why wouldn't we want to stop at Washington then? Why wouldn't we want to locate power at the state level, at the local level, and as close as possible to the individual and the family? That's what I'm in favor of. And that's a thing that gets lost. I mean, the very name of nationalism that they've chosen to emphasize the nation and the national interest, it necessarily ends up then subsuming individual interests, saying you are a cog in the machine. Your choices, your rights may be sacrificed to the national interest. And that makes me very uncomfortable.
Do you think in any way that this call for more muscular government, more government intervention in our economy is a response to an image problem that free markets have, both from the left and now from some on the right? Is the idea of free markets, does that idea need a better sell job in this day and age?
I think it's always important to be defending the importance of freedom and free markets. So, you know, that is not a task that's ever going to be over. So, of course, to the extent that, say, public opinion may be moving away from support for free market capitalism, for free markets and that sort of thing, then people like me who believe that markets are the engine of growth and wealth creation and human flourishing, you know, a condition of human flourishing, one among many, but in a pretty important one, mm-hmm. That means we have more work to do. We need to be defending. We need to be making the case for that, of course. But I would also caution against drawing too many conclusions from things like the rise of the nationalist conservative movement or Trump's election in 2016. There are a lot of people who say, well, this just goes to show that the Republican Party has lost touch with where real Americans are. People don't support globalization or foreign trade or free markets anymore. Actually, you look at polling data and you find that even the people who voted for Donald Trump in 2020 are split down the middle on things like free trade and whether they support free trade and they think it's good for the country. There are a lot of other issues where there's unanimous support, and those tend to be or unanimous agreement, and those tend to be centered around cultural issues, a sense that our cultural fabric is under attack. It's no longer safe to be a practicing Christian in this country, or the mainstream media is against us. And those are the issues that have nothing to do with economic policy, that have everything to do with the ways that our culture has changed and the ways that the left has really, I think, overreached and in sometimes quite egregious ways made whole swaths of America feel increasingly like they're no longer welcome in their own country. That's a very dangerous thing. You get backlash when that happens. And that's kind of what you're seeing, I think, with the rise of these movements. So I don't want to deny that there are problems that folks are, especially on the right, these conservatives aren't, I'm not saying that they're imagining these things that they're reacting against. There's real problems. There's assaults on religious liberty. Mm-hmm. There's, as you said, attempts to tear down statues, including of some of our national heroes, not just Confederate soldiers, but George Washington, for example. These things, people are reacting against that, and that's understandable. But again, the question is, does that justify then the desire, you know, does it then give us the right to give into our temptation to seize power and wield it to go after our enemies and use it to destroy them? And that's the kind of thing that you often are hearing now. I mean, more and more explicitly coming from the national conservative movement.
Stephanie Slade is with us here on the Future of Freedom podcast. She's senior editor at Reason. Find her on Twitter at SladeSR. On this question of a cultural fight, those supportive of this new nationalism on the right talk about America as a cultural nation, not just an idea, but an American culture. Does America have a culture? Does government have any role in promoting or preserving it?
To the extent that the federal government is involved in our education system, then it will necessarily have a role in deciding, you know, what we teach our children. But, you know, traditionally, the conservative position was that the federal government shouldn't be involved in education, that should be left to states and localities and parents and families to decide what values are we going to promote and what are the values that we want to pass down to our children and to the next generation. I think that there tends to be, there is this, we've lost sight of the fact that there are many, many, many ways to solve problems or to promote things that we think are necessary for human flourishing that don't involve government at all, that persuasion, that culture change, that institution building at the civil society level, that families and parents and you know, members, neighbors, you know, members of the community should be on the front lines of doing this work. And that includes, that's true when it comes to solving all sorts of problems, including a problem of, you know, what are the values that we want to pass down to the next generation? What is the sort of fabric of our society that we want to build and preserve? If we're expecting Washington to do that, I mean, think about the people that we sent to Washington. I don't want them deciding what the values are that our country represents, or what things our kids should be learning to treasure. They should work for us, and we should be doing the hard work, the sort of hard work of being on the front lines of doing that sort of thing, I think, at the community level and at the family level as much as possible.
We hear often about American exceptionalism, America being different than every other country in the world, essentially. Do you hold out any, I don't want to say hope, but do you hold out the possibility that this strain of American nationalism would become something different than what we see from nationalism essentially everywhere else, that there is perhaps an American exceptionalism when it comes to nationalism as well?
I believe in American exceptionalism. And I think one of the things that you're not seeing as much from the current national conservatism movement is a sort of outward-looking desire for military supremacy, the military interventionism. There's not so much a desire to send the American military out into the world to control and to protect and to be a global leader. That seems to not be a major force within the national conservatism movement as it's currently manifesting, which is quite interesting because that almost imperial impulse has frequently, almost always in history, been associated with nationalist movements. You think about nationalism rising in Europe, and then you think of armies invading and trying to conquer. And so we haven't seen that much. And I think that's just one sign of many that America is special. We are not that kind of imperial nation. We do not have the impulse to go and conquer and enslave. And I'm very glad about that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that. What remains of the nationalist agenda is the stuff that I can line up behind. So, you know, again, to the extent that we're talking about something that's coercive, that involves centralizing power in Washington and moving away, you know, decision-making away from individuals and families and moving it way, you know, farther away to the national government, to the extent that we are talking about overriding the rights of individual people to make choices for themselves coercively. You know, we're not just talking about, hey, let's try to encourage people to buy American to support their fellow citizens, but rather passing laws, imposing tariffs, you know, forcing people to pay more for American-made goods, whether they like it or not. This is the sort of thing that I think is it's no different from nationalism as it has traditionally appeared in other venues, the sort of mercantilist, protectionist, us versus them, you know, America first, so to speak. And that's not, that just, you know, I mean, the whole idea of America first sort of flies in the face of the American exceptionalism where we're a beacon, where we are a leader by example, where we are happy to see as many other countries and as many other peoples as want to follow our example as possible do so and flourish in the same way that we do. That's the kind of American exceptionalism that I'm for, and I don't see very much of that in the nationalist movement, again, as it's actually being practiced right now.
And on this idea of us versus them, Stephanie, do you see a rural-urban divide when it comes to this idea of nationalism on the right? And does that sort of, again, us versus them division bother you? Should it worry us?
Anytime you're promoting sort of tribalism or us versus them mentality, I'm going to be nervous because the whole sort of idea behind classical liberalism was that we should be able to coexist peacefully with those, even if we don't share all their same values, right? Even if we don't agree with how they choose to live their life, they might not agree with how we choose to live our life, but we forego the temptation to use coercion, you know, violence against them to force them, to coerce them into living the way we want them to live. And it's a mutual forbearance. That's classical liberalism in a nutshell. And so that's the thing that we lose a little bit when we talk about imposing a one-size-fits-all solution from the top down, from Washington on everyone.
Stephanie Slade, she is senior editor at Reason. You can find her there at reason.com and also on Twitter at SladeSR. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us here on the Future of Freedom podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Scott Bertram. We thank both of our guests on today's program, Stephanie Slade, senior editor at Reason, and also Rich Lowry, editor at National Review and author of the book, The Case for Nationalism.
For more episodes of the Future of Freedom podcast and other fine podcasts from America's Talking Network, check out americastalking.com or wherever you find your podcasts. Thank you for listening to Future of Freedom, presented by America's Talking Network.